Director as producer, getting organized. Welcome to the Midwest Radio Theater Workshop's Technical Assistance Best Of Series. You'll be hearing the voices and thoughts of some of our favorite workshop trainers and performers from the past 10 years. This isn't everything they said or meant to say, but it is a good place to start. As you listen, be distracted by your own thoughts and experiences on the subject. After all, radio theater is art, it's personal, it's fun, and it's up for grabs. On this tape, we'll be discussing the role of the director as a producer, problem solver, and technician. These are all very different jobs and demand different qualities, but very often because of budget considerations, the radio theater director is forced to wear many hats, each with its own responsibilities and decisions. First, let's hear how directors Norman Jio, David Osman, and Vanessa Whitburn get started.
The directorial relationship not only has to be concerned with the talent, but it has to be concerned with the writer, it has to be concerned with the technical limitations of the medium that you're working with. Sometimes it has to be extremely concerned with the budget. In fact, all the time. I mean, it's hard to escape the reality of what the budget and the front office is going to do to your production. And that's something, as a director, you got to set yourself in the middle of that and deal. One side of your brain's got to deal with the front office, the budgetary constraints, the logistics, when to be there, when not to be there. And it's very hard to get to a place where you're dealing with the substance of another human being when you're thinking about, should I be here or should I be someplace else? Do I have all my roles filled? Am I going to go overtime? Am I going to get bumped out of the studio in the next hour? All of that dynamic can really distract you from going inside of another human being. When I approach a project, I try to structurally deal with the logs, the staff, the systems, the lines of communication that will just free me up to go inside, to get lost.
Pre-production, casting, script editing, sound gathering, studio preparation, organizing the recording day, managing voice tracks for editing, and methods of post-production. First thing I do when I get to a script is to divide it into scenes. And I think this is a very important approach to... This is assuming you are not writing the script, you're doing somebody's script, and there it is. A scene, I draw a line through the page and start numbering scenes from the top of whatever the beginning is. And the scenes, it depends a little bit on what the piece of material is, but generally a scene will end when there is a change in the ambience. There's a change in the background or location. Sometimes the scene changes when a new character enters. This is the classic Shakespearean scene. You know, if you didn't have a lion in the office up until page 10, then as soon as the lion enters the office, I would draw a lion across the page and consider it new, because there would be a whole lot of other production problems that would enter. And then I would come to the point where I was doing rehearsals, and we would only have the lion for the lion's scene, you know, and I'd probably kind of schedule that toward the end of the day after all the edible actors had left. And in breaking it up this way, then from then on, I refer to it in my own mind and in all pre-production preparation in terms of whatever those scenes are. As a basic method for organizing your thinking about a radio play, it's invaluable.
The more mundane business of being a radio drama director, which isn't mundane, but nevertheless, the more organizational is also important. It's no good coming in with wonderful ideas about how you can communicate with Sir Laurence Olivier better than anybody else into your radio studio if your script's in a mess, if your technicians don't have a clue what you're doing, and if furthermore you have no method of remembering the difference between the first time the actor did that scene and the second time, the third time, the fourth time, and therefore you're just making them do it again and again and again for heaven knows what combination of reasons, just to take up the clock time. Let's presuppose that you've talked to your writer, they have produced a script, and you are happy with that script, artistically and technically. What the heck do you do? Well, the first thing that we do is to get it typed in a format that makes it easy to work with.
My favorite format these days is to number only the speeches, not the lines.
We also do things like we type sound effects, notices to our technical crew in capital letters in the centre of the page, simply because then they look at the page and straight away they can see the bit that refers to them. And if I get a script which has got an awful lot of thoughtfully, smilingly, laughingly, I tend to cross them out, because the last thing an actor is a parrot, and they do not want to come to a studio and be told how to say every single line, because they'll end up just going laughing, sad, oh, surprised, and they won't be giving you an emotional performance. And it is never true of drama that there is only one way to say a line anyway. So, you know, the writer might think it needs to be said thoughtfully. Perhaps you get a wonderful actor who will decide that the way to say this is pretty spikily, and it will work within the context of what is happening. So I don't like to pin them down. But the other little tip is, as we all know, script noises are a real pain in the neck, aren't they, on radio? I mean, people turning their scripts. So try not to get your typist to type a speech over the page, you know, in the middle, so that he's going, and then she went down to, you know, because this causes a lot of problems. So, again, if they can finish speeches or scenes at the bottom of pages and so on. I mean, it's all very mundane stuff, but it's terribly important.
Okay, you have your script prepared. Now you need a plan to get the production on tape. Decide what you need and when and where it fits in. You've always got to be a step ahead.
Then, as a director, make a list of your Foley effects, make a list of your recorded effects as you want them, because sometimes they're in the script and sometimes they're as you're hearing them, and you might think they're in the script because you know the piece so well because you've read it a lot. And I had an example of this yesterday. I realised that I'm assuming things in the little script we're doing on Saturday because I can hear it in a certain way, but I'm not going to get it unless I get down and do the boring old business of writing out a list.
Before you know it, you have a sequential listing of all your effects, right? But as you know, that's not necessarily a good idea to deal with going out and recording. Let me do a subtext. This is all up here. You need props, bods, location, notes. Anything that you want to be specific. You say background hum, right? BG hum on this first one. This one here, I want to pan left and right, take over the soundscape, develop it like... take over, and then it goes to silence. I would make a little notation in there that that's what that one's about. It's hard to remember, and you don't want to have to go through your script every goddamn minute to figure this thing out. You want to be able to trust a system that has mm-hmm. it all in two pages. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you go down, you have beach, and then you have bar, scene, and you have, for the bar scene, you have seven people, background people, props, glasses, and you go on down, and then you have beach here again, right? Now, I don't know if you've ever done this early on, where you come down, you got your list, and you say, okay, we've broken the script down, and we're ready to go record, and you come in and record this. Ooh, a spaceship, we do the spaceship, and we come down here, we go to the beach. And then you come down, and 5 days later, now you're doing an episode. You realize that in scene episode number two, you got two scenes at the beach. And shit, you realize, wow, we went to the beach on Monday. We got to go back to the beach. Now that's very obvious, and you say to yourself, well, I'm not so stupid, I'm going to not do that. This is a very obvious one. It can get so subtle that this becomes a tremendous logistical
feat. So what you need is a location sheet, right?
What you end up with is all your beach scenes on one location setting, and you group everything by where you do them. Studio stuff on one sheet, beach stuff on one sheet. And then you go ahead and you add up the highest number of bodies, and that becomes the people that you have to have there, plus your engineering. Or if it is your engineering, you know, two people walking, maybe one of them is going to be your engineer, another footsteps to a field. And you get your logistical facts from this. They group down and you say, all right, to do the beach stuff, we go down and we do episode scenes. Episodes 1, 3, 4, scenes 12, blah, blah, blah. You also put your scene numbers here and episode numbers. And then we go to the beach. Now, what is it going to take? We have to be there at high noon to get the best crowd ambience for playing on the beach. But we also have to get there early to get that nice sound without anybody there. So, and then you count up. This one's going to take us. We have a ratio we want. 5 minutes of this that we need for the scene, so we're going to probably do a ratio of 2 to 1, 2 takes, minimum. If it's if we get some weird sound like a plane that goes by, we may lose it. You figure 20 minutes, so you have a time allotment count, estimate, right, time, and then you add up all that and you say, we're at the beach for a day, okay? So you know this is Thursday, and you slate it out, and you don't try to go over there and do bar scenes on that day.
Ordinarily, I would say if you were organizing a recording schedule and everybody was in the same town, the same place, to record the scenes using the most actors first, and to, as you go through your day, to drop actors out as soon as they are finished. This means you only are paying $10 an hour to the people who are actually working, not people who are sitting around. We had enough money in our War of the Worlds budget to pay people to sit around for, I mean, you know, because it amounted to another $50, which is a very small increment of a $100,000 budget. We could not afford to hold our actors longer than 2 days. Because it's like a film. We were running on a very high, you know, those 2 days were costing us a great deal of money just to be up and running. And then the minute you get back into post-production, then your expenses go way back down again. But the 2 days you're recording, because you're providing food, we provided food, lodging, and transportation for everybody at a high level. So they all had a good time. And that was appreciated by the members of the company, and consequently they did not mind waiting all day to come and do their scenes, because I knew they would have to. So we provided lots of food and a pool to swim in and everything else that they would need.
The issue about how you treat people who work for you is very important. Like, I don't pay that much for actors. It's not that high. So I make sure that they're fed. I make sure that it's fun for them. I make sure that the crew is feeling good and everybody, it's easy and it's relaxed. That any tension or any weirdness goes on when they don't see it. Because I want them to spread it around with their friends at doing it. It's a lot of fun. Hey, go work for those guys. It's fun. And so far we've managed to do that.
As David and Marjorie Van Halteren point out, do what you can for your crew. You may not be able to provide a swimming pool, but basic considerations can make everybody feel appreciated. Now, Vanessa and Norman suggest some ways to keep track of the production once tape is rolling.
When I'm listening, and I'll think, it's a bit slow, so I might write down pace, or I might write down tears, or I might write down move on mic, too much voice, too loud, too, and they're instant judgments on what I'm hearing. And I just scribble it down. And then I say, that was lovely, or that was terrible, but that was lovely. Want to do it one more time, few things to think about, hang on. And I talk to my technicians, maybe if there's any technical things, and I'm racing, I talk to my actors, and I'm saying things like, I'm going to pace that bit up because it's an argument, you know. And I think, you know, you're angry, she's not too happy, you can afford to give it a bit more, you know, come on, you don't like her at this moment, come on, let's have a bit of anger in that. And so I'm conducting it and changing it a little bit. And all that. Now, say this is a difficult scene. We've done 4 takes, right? And it's not bad, but I still want more. I've only got 1 script in front of me. How the heck am I going to know what note refers to take 1, what note refers to take 2? It's no good going in the studio with actors and saying, oh, just a minute, what did I want there? And you know, and so what I do is use different colour pens for different colour takes, felt tip pens. So my script looks like a baby's script.
This is directing traffic. Why do you direct traffic so you don't have any accidents? And why? What are you trying to prevent from having an accident? Human beings from getting, you know, and it gets back to the human factor. All this relates to getting that human being in the studio to utter that line with the effect and the music all at the same time in the moment of the here and now. And once it's done, it's executed and it's in tape. Now, that's where you got to ride the wave, right at that moment. That second in the studio, he's directing it right there. Boom, being so in touch with the chi and the force of it that it's right there, you've got it.
If at all possible, get yourself a good assistant.
Traditionally, particularly in film, the assistant director carries the weight of the kick, the time, the logistics, can read and think 4, 5, 6 scenes deep and 3 days of shooting it or 3 days of studio work, and knows where everything should be as it moves up to what? To the actual moment when you execute the scene. That's when tape is rolling, cameras are rolling. Everything is executed in real time, in the present. And the present is the quickest moment that comes down. Everything moves from the past, from the future into the present. In other words, all the scenes are stacked up, and you have multiple relationships with time, where the assistant director should be able to know what time the scene is that we're in right now, if we're over time by the approximation, is it running too long, is it running too short, but they also know who's up next and where those actors are that are coming up next, and who will be up tomorrow. Now, if you can get your actors and your production crew and everybody to relate to that person to manage, hey, we're behind, folks. Let's keep going. Let's push. If somebody handles the kick, if the AD is on it, then you don't have to worry about it. Then you can have a relationship where the AD can come in your ear and say, we're about 10 minutes over. Why don't you keep going? Or why don't you wrap this scene now? That's like a little Jiminy Cricket in your ear. It's critical. And that doesn't happen by accident. A good AD can be there, but you've got to have some experience and time to develop that. To me, that's the most critical position, to allow yourself to be free, and you as a director want to build it.
We're going to change gears here for a bit and discuss the producer's role in dealing with the outside world. Norman and Marjorie are both experts at this.
You have a production where, in most community radio stations, you don't have a delineation between director. The producer is the director, and nobody knows that the word director is used. But when you go in there and say, do this and that, you're actually directing, but nobody knows that, and nobody gives you credit for that. You at least must know the division of responsibilities in the medium, that there is directing, that's in charge of the aesthetic. There is producing, that's in charge of the dynamics to make it happen, from money to structures, facilitation, to everything. And then you have your technical wing, which is completely on the other side, implementing aesthetic, yet you know how technical realities are. They're hardwired. They, you know, you get people just as apt to talk about impedance for an hour and get off on it. And it has a direct relationship to the aesthetic, but an indirect flow.
I think of a producer as a problem solver. If you're a person that doesn't like to solve difficult problems, producing is probably not for you. Maybe writing or acting or something else is better. But seriously, but a producer has to be the person that is willing to put themselves in front of everything. When we go into a difficult situation, when I'm working with a production, I know that I'm the ultimate, I'm the bottom of the line. When I was younger, I didn't like that very much. I always wanted to find somebody else to hand it to. There isn't anybody else. And once you become comfortable with that reality, you're on your way to becoming a good producer. If you can live with the idea that there's no one else to go to be assured that the problem is solved but yourself, then you're a producer.
Through a workshop, Marjorie touches on a few subjects that might give you some idea of what to consider when you're putting a project together.
First of all, always be honest with people. Remember to always give everybody ahead of time. It's almost like being a lawyer. You remember, or just being a good friend, just remember you're honest and upfront about everything with people, no matter how painful it is, no matter how much you don't want to bring it up. You tell them. You don't sort of try to insinuate, yeah, there'll be a great article, you'll probably be in it, because you're going to pay down the road.
Before we leave this, are contracts a good thing to try and do in a situation like that?
Writing is always good. A contract, it depends. If it's just for reading to come do a performance, yes, you ought to have a contract about the use of that performance. If you're going to record it and do things with it, you've got to straighten that out. But if it's just something kind of informal, a letter is not a bad thing. You send him a letter saying, hi, remember our phone conversation? This is what you said you'd do and when you said you'd do it. And then he has the letter and you know, acknowledge receipt of it. Or ask him to write it to you, or have his agent write it to you, or his secretary or someone, his assistant. It's someone who's got that kind of staff around them. And then it's in your file, and there's no... The thing is communication. Clean up, you know, make it clear.
I probably would have gotten everything straight from everybody and sent them all a letter copying everybody, what everyone said and what everyone promised, so that when it hits their desk and it's something they don't want to do, they'll call me back and say, wait a minute, I didn't realize I was telling you I was going to give you this.
If there is any chance to make money on it, I have to renegotiate with each and every
one of
you.
That's what my contracts say in my...
Renegotiation.
Well, it says that if there's a book deal, they have to get paid like royalties. Cassettes are only non-commercial. I can't go to Simon & Schuster and cut a deal and cut them out of it. All those things have been taken into consideration. The actors, I try to buy everything outright because there's just too many actors, and I have to be honest with them and tell them what the situation is. there might be some non-commercial cassettes. It's unlikely that there'll be commercial cassettes if they are the actors. The writers will get a royalty, and that's the way it goes. And it probably will never make us a lot of money, but we're not aiming for that. But you have to consider all those things, all those people involved. I don't mean to say when you sit down to do some kind of casual little fun production, you don't have to slap a contract in everybody's face. You know, it's like, you know, it sounds kind of pretentious, like, oh, when we sell this to Hollywood, you know. But you should think about it in the beginning, what your philosophy is about it, and how you deal with people and what you tell them about what you're doing.
I had a barbecue in the backyard once for all the actors that came over.
Yeah.
You know, that was really all they got out of it, was a tape and a barbecue.
Yeah, and it's nice to tell them in the beginning. I tell the actors, I said, you go, everybody gets a tape, everybody gets the amount of money that we pay, and everybody gets fed while you're working. That's it. That's all I can do. I make tapes for absolutely everybody, and I make them myself in my house if I have to.
You're just about ready to finish up on your recording. The actors are great. You get the feeling that the writer really liked it, too. But before everyone goes home, the writer takes you aside.
You know, you left out a very important word to me.
What was that?
Well, you know that line where she said, I want a soda?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The line is supposed to be, I want the soda.
I want the soda as opposed to I want a soda.
Yes.
Is that right? Are you sure you heard it correctly?
Yes, I heard it correctly, and that's what I need.
Right.
The whole concept just breaks apart if you say the instead of a.
Okay. Have you double-checked your script to see that? Because on my script it said, I see a soda. And our finished script said a soda.
I don't know. Maybe
so could you go back and check your work and make sure, because our final script, which you approved, said the soda, and we proceeded with that so superbly, I don't see how we can.
Okay, let's talk about this. How much right does he have? It's very funny. It probably wouldn't be something that small, but how it might be. But you just say, sorry, Bob, you signed a contract, I guess. Now, how much right does he have to go at you? And what I'm getting at is the whole thing is, go back to the beginning. What did you agree to, and how? What was your process like? Let's talk about all the issues involved.
I would say, as a human being, he certainly has the right to come up to you and say something. As a professional, he has none, at least in the way we work, because we work very closely with the writers in pre-production. And we invite them to come to the taping, mm-hmm. even if they want to come in post and sit through mixing, which they never do. But, I mean, we invite them to do everything, but they understand from the beginning that the night of the taping, their job is totally and completely finished, and they have nothing to say.
Well, you brought up a point when you say that it's important. When I was in advertising, it was always a rule of thumb, was that presence is witness. It's like in the advertising business, they make sure that everybody who has anything, any power to make us stink about anything, like the client or the account executive, whatever, is present when money is spent. When the meter runs, they're in the room. If the meter was running and they weren't in the room, it's their fault. But if you said, everybody, Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, we're all going to be at the production, we're going to be shooting this spot, and everybody's expected to be there, there's no Monday morning quarterbacking. We do invite the writer to be there at every moment if they want to be, including post-production, and sometimes they do come. I had one writer who just was there with practically hands-on from absolutely beginning to end and had a great time and acted in it and everything, which is fine. But so then I had one writer, I never saw her. She didn't even come to the performance because she was jetting around somewhere, you know, which I don't care for because we didn't know that was going to happen, but it's not as good because she wasn't too happy with something. She wasn't too happy that we didn't call her up the next day and tell her how wonderful it was, but we didn't know where she was. It's important to get it again. It's honesty again. Get it straight. What are you expect of this person? And what do they expect of the experience? And what's it going to be? A lot of times people just buy a script or they get a script from someone, and then they get into a little bit of anxiety about, do I have to tell them that I did this? Or what? It's unclear, and I think that has to be made absolutely clear. What am I buying from you? This money I paid you, I'm buying the right to do anything I want to it. However, I will consult you in the following way. And it has to do with what you do in the beginning. I've done that many times where I said, look, you're brilliant, wonderful, and talented, but you haven't done radio. And so I got to tell you what this project is all about. We make it into radio. And that might mean that we change a lot of stuff. And if you agree to sell me your script, that may happen. And you have to be able to accept that or don't do the project. And if they accept it, they go along with it, and they love it. With the radio stage, I had a strange thing where I decided that I would not hire anybody but radio directors. I just decided in the beginning it was never going to be anybody but radio directors. And I got people tried talking me into theater directors all the time, and I always held firm on it. And I actually did work with a couple of sort of quasi-theater people, and it was difficult because we did very technological work. And people accepted that. I just held my ground. But I held my ground from the beginning. It wasn't like in the middle I kind of vacillated on it. It was from day one to minute. And I also have a policy of no matter who it is, I don't care how famous or heavy they are.
In this world, money is always a problem. David Osman.
They had just put somebody on his board, who was an accountant. And may I suggest, it's really good to have a fiscally responsible person connected with anything you're doing if you are spending any money. And if you have a nonprofit or something like that, make sure that you've got a CPA involved and somebody who's writing checks. And it's very important to have your business handled. Taxes days are just fierce, horrible. And you can't not spend any money. I mean, it's impossible to do not to spend any money. I mean, you can spend an absolute minimum amount, but you want that administered as well as you possibly can.
I'm talking about consistency, continuity with people. People will make you crazy if they're not consistent with you. If you found that you haven't been, I had a terrible time with someone that I hired where I wasn't consistent with this person. I had to admit it. Someone I was talking to several hundred thousands of miles was going to come out and do some work for me, and I led him in a long conversation that I had with him where I was dead exhausted. I'd been up all night, and his production was going on. It was going to be coming in, and I had done another one, and it was in 1 week we were going to start rehearsal for another one, and I had no oomph left in my body, and we had a very long conversation, bicostal conversation, where we said a lot of philosophical things to each other that were very interesting, and I agreed with him. 2 days later, I realized that what he was asking me to do, I could not do. And he had to stand by what he thought was right, and I had to stand by what I thought was right, and I had to say it was my responsibility to not be inconsistent with you, I'm sorry. But I was tired, and I lost sight of something. It was honesty. I took it on myself, but I stood firm. That's the two things, honesty, upfront, on paper, everything. Whether or not you're going to pay for their phone calls in the hotel, things like that, everything, so that there's no problems. Risk offending them with your presumption and your detail, because you won't be sorry. Oh, another thing you're good at if you're a producer is researching, just like other jobs like writers. I always know who to call. If I have a question, I get out the yellow pages if I don't. Resourcefulness, that's part of problem solving, is to be utterly resourceful. You don't always have to know everything. I don't know everything about everything, obviously, but I sure know who to pick up the phone and call, and if they don't know, then they find somebody for me to call, and I just call and call and call and call. God, thank God they invented the telephone, until I find that person. Sometimes it's not solvable, and then I have to be the one that makes that decision. I can't do anything about this, and we live with it.
As a director, you're always balancing what are the technical requirements and the economic requirements, studio time, money, and what are the artistic requirements. It's always a compromise, or usually a compromise. I think once or twice it hasn't been. But it's always, to a certain extent, a compromise. But you are the only one who can balance them, because your technicians will not know the full scale of your artistic complications, and your artist will not know or care about the full scale of your technical complications, and certainly nobody cares about your economic complications except you.
Hope these words helped. Please flip the tape.
Yeah, all right, need a grant. Yeah, while you're up, get me a grant. Oh, I love it. I just love it.